Thank you for having me at your meeting, everybody. I am a compulsive overeater. I'm a compulsive eater, and I'm a food addict. And for me, all three of those things have a little bit different nuances. That's why I say all three. I'm a compulsive eater, compulsive overeater, and a food addict. I am abstinent today by the grace of my higher power and lots of help from the fellowship. You know, I hope that people will get something from what I have to share today. I really do hope to be helpful, but I guess the important thing is that I show up and I tell the truth and I try to be helpful because that's what people did for me. I'm going to hopefully break it up into what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And if I get done early, for me, that'll be a victory because then I'll get to hear more of what you all have to say. And I do believe that people also get well by speaking and listening, that balance. I guess I'll tell you what it was like. I always found this part of people's stories interesting. I never have enough time to tell where I came from, whence I came, right? So I like to do a little biography. I was born on February 28th, 1966. I was adopted at 6 months old to a loving couple that really wanted a child. So I was very blessed. Where do we go from here? I was very self-conscious, very perfectionistic. I'm going to try to leave blame out of this. So I'm going to just try to explain the facts without saying who, what, where, or why. I was a loved kid, so I'm not going to kind of go into a lot of trauma type of stuff because that's, in general, it's not my experience. But I definitely had a lot of heartache and struggles in my life, a lot. I seem to think that I was one of the only ones. Now I'm coming to realize at the age of 56 that probably most human beings could say that same thing, that life has been hard and there's been a lot of struggles. My struggles were so poignant and eventually they got me close to death. Particularly my struggles with mental illness and addiction, that I tend to think of myself, my own struggles as more poignant than anyone else's, which is not true. It's just that it was very, very scary and very unpleasant. But I did have a semi-pleasant childhood. Like I said, I was very self-conscious. I believe that I was groomed to be somebody that needed to look for something outside of myself to make me feel better from a very young age. And it was almost taught to me in a way to look for something outside of myself that I could rely on to medicate those feelings of not feeling good enough, not feeling like I belonged, feeling insecure and self-conscious. And I looked for those feelings in different ways. And eventually, as I struggled more and more with depression, it was real clear that the food was going to medicate me. I was lucky. I was an active kid. I was very sick with asthma, but I was weight-wise, I was kind of too skinny. But people didn't really get mad at me for being too skinny. What I mean by that is I didn't catch a lot of flack for that. I did catch a lot of flack for the way I looked, though. And I'm not going to go into that. But there were some features that I had that I got made fun of very, very intensely. When I was a kid, I felt like somebody was ripping my guts out. I also had some things at home that kind of emphasized that. So I felt like I was deformed. Although I technically probably wasn't deformed, I actually saw myself as someone who was deformed. So I can kind of relate to sometimes when people have had that horrible overweight experience as a kid. Although I didn't have that, I did feel deformed. That was a very unsettling feeling. So I grew up feeling very insecure about myself. As I got older, as I headed towards my teen years, I became more and more unhappy. And I didn't expect good things because, like I said, I felt like, I guess I would say ugly. You know, I felt like, well, when you're ugly, what can you expect? And so I had some ways of compensating for that. One of the ways of compensating was overachieving in school and like studying, whereas most kids might have been hanging out or watching too much TV. I was studying for 6 hours a day in private school, in high school. I did get quite a bit of praise for that, but I also sometimes people looked at me and said, like, what's her problem? Why doesn't she go out more? Like, why is she so isolated? But that was my way of overcompensating for probably thinking I was ugly. Back in the day when I grew up, I felt like how a woman looked was basically what defined her. That was my thought. Could have been wrong, but my thought was, you know, beautiful women, pretty women, popular women, they had it all. And I had none of that. So I had to study. So I did. So when did the food enter? Interestingly enough, the food really entered for me. And I'll say it in front of men, when I got my period. I think I was 15 years old. Up until that, I'd been very thin, maybe even a little underweight. When I got my period in 10th grade, I became ravenous. Now, mind you, I wasn't ravenous for the entire month. But the 10 days prior to, my body would go through cravings that were so, so strong. And people knew it in my family. They knew, oh, you know, she's premenstrual. And not only that, but I was depressed. I became addicted to sugar, but chocolate. The chocolate really, the cravings were so bad. I tried to mitigate the cravings by exercising, by starving, but I really couldn't control my appetite. And I did get messages from my family like, how come you're eating like that? We just had dinner. Why don't you have a bowl of cereal with your box instead of a box of cereal with your bowl? You know, it was like, wow. Very thankfully, I never got obese. I also was somebody who liked exercising, and I would have reprieves from those cravings. And during the reprieves, I would get very active. And I also had a lot of encouragement from my family not to be overweight. And that seemed to help me. So that's kind of what it was like. I did go to college. In college, I isolated, I studied, and I used food as my friend and as my panacea. I also tried to be a compulsive exerciser, knowing that the reason I was compulsively exercising was so I wouldn't be overweight. My family member encouraged it, that I would exercise compulsively because I ate less and I didn't gain weight. So I really set out to do that, and it worked for a little while till it didn't work anymore. Probably stopped working my sophomore year in college, and I began to, you know, put on a little bit of weight. And I also struggled concurrently with depression, and the depression was pretty black. It was really a sense of, don't want to like sidetrack too much into the depression, but it was really a sense of, I don't want to be alive. Very clearly, like what makes other people tick, because I really don't want to be alive. I guess maybe it's divine intervention. I looked for other things to want to make me be alive. So I relied on the exercise. I relied on the food. I relied on the studying. I relied on anything that would give me that sense of wanting to be alive. And that's kind of where I think a lot of my addictions stem from. I have nothing to be alive. I want something to energize me and motivate me. So that's kind of what it was like. I'm very thankful I made it through college, because I remember towards the end of college, I felt a little bit like I was losing my mind. I didn't have a whole lot of experience with the psychiatric world and stuff, but I was thinking, I feel like I should be in a hospital, like with these fleeting thoughts of, I think I should be in a hospital. But I managed to graduate, you know, with the help of my higher power, did very well. And things got much worse after I graduated college, because now I had no direction and I was struggling with core identity issues. And I went into the sugar, and it was a very painful black period. Well, the good news is this is where the OA comes in, because I guess now I'm getting to what happened. So in 1989, a year after college, I was living in a city. I was very alienated and alone. I was trying to drink and make friends and do normal things, but it wasn't really working. I saw a sign for Overeaters Anonymous. They had questions. Do you eat when you're not hungry? Do you isolate to eat? And I'm rewording it wrongly, but it was just a bunch of questions. Yes, no. And I wasn't overweight at the time, but again, I had body dysmorphia like many of us. I mean, I really felt ugly, and I was probably a few pounds from all the sugar. And I said, yeah, that fits me. And so I went to that meeting Sunday night in 1989, and it was like September. It was like the holiday weekend in September of 1989. And I went to that meeting, and people were welcoming. From that meeting on, I've been to meetings for the past 33 years. That's pretty much what I did in the beginning. I just showed up at meeting after meeting, and I listened to people's stories. I was in Boston, Massachusetts. There was a lot of strong recovery there. There are a lot of young people that were completely abstinent, and they were talking a lot about how their lives were good. Then there were other people who were like me, they were depressed and mildly suicidal, and they would show up at the meetings too. We'd had meetings, like I used to go to my depressive meetings where people would talk about how they were thinking of why were they here, they were suicidal. I went to a variety of meetings, which was, and I'm not saying that to make fun of the meetings, they were good for me, because those meetings where people were depressed and didn't really want to be alive, that was actually helpful to me back then. Because when I went to meetings and I saw people that were really functional and were smiling, I didn't relate, and it was very hard. So I forget that now, because I don't need to go to meetings like that anymore, but I did back then. So I guess I'm just realizing that those meetings helped save my life almost as much as the strong meetings did, because I could identify in and I felt like I really wasn't alone. There were people struggling and suffering just as much as me, but there was always recovery there too. And I learned so much over these past 33 years. And one of my friends in early OA back 33 years ago, she used to always say, you know, Tina, this disease wants me dead. She had really good recovery. She was a recovering bulimic. She would go to the depressive meetings where the people were, like I said, like myself, very, very depressed. She would come to all those meetings and she wasn't. She had recovery. She'd always say in all those meetings, this disease wants me dead. It doesn't want me to eat. It doesn't want, you know, it wants me dead. And I remember her saying that. I'll still remember her always saying that this disease wants me dead. And it does. So I got into OA, and then I guess I'm back to what happened. I struggled a lot. I had a sponsor back then in like 1990, I think, or 1991. And she just said, I can't continue to sponsor you unless you go to treatment. And I rebelled, but not here to talk about outside issues, but there was a hospital in Tampa for food addiction. I'm not going to dwell on that, but I actually did go to that twice. The important thing about treatment is it got me to take the food addiction more seriously. It showed me that my compulsive eating was also an addiction. And I was taught and forced in the beginning to weigh and measure my food when I went to that treatment center. And I was forced to eliminate certain foods that really didn't work for me. And did I rebel? Oh, yeah. I mean, even before then, I was trying to weigh and measure. And I remember taking the plastic scale that I would get a strict sponsor who taught me to weigh and measure. And we didn't have electronic scales. We had plastic ones back then. And I was living alone and I took it and I was so angry and I threw it in my kitchen. I remember it always had a big crack in the little cup on top. My story might be mine and complicated, but really that first step, I think for many people in all programs, that first step is a real hard one. Surrender to whatever it is I'm doing to self-medicate, that is really, really hard. Surrendering the food was one of the hardest things that had to be done, because I really don't feel like I've done it. It took decades. For me, my resistance was so great. It took a lot of help, a lot of meetings. I wrote an article for our newsletter on seventh tradition. And I calculated that if I gave a seventh tradition at every meeting I've ever been to, I would have contributed about $200,000 by now in that little basket, you know, and it's like, wow, you know, that's seventh tradition. So just imagine if I had to pay $50 for every service I got, it would be in the multi-millions. What I'm saying is I didn't do any of this alone. That was my point in saying that. I didn't feel like I surrendered the food alone, but I did keep at it. I tried to follow directions and I did it with a lot of anger. I found that there was a place, and it wasn't always necessarily OA, but there was a place that could allow me to express my anger. And I needed that. And it really helped me with my recovery to be able to not fake it and say, oh, it's all good. I was able to get that rage and that anger out. It was like, food's the only thing that makes me happy. And now I have to give this up. What are you, crazy? It was that lie. It was the anger, but it was also, now I know it's a lie. Back then, I didn't know it was a lie. Back then, it seemed real to me. It seemed like this thing that I want to eat or taste or do whatever is really helping me. This is a good thing. And now I've learned over the years that that's the lie of my disease. Something can look good, it can smell good, and it can even taste good. But it can be a lie that ingesting that item is going to make my life better. Because the truth is, ingesting that item is going to make my life worse. So kind of getting into the sort of solution a little bit. So I was explained to me that I have a lot of lies and a lot of fears. Because if I look at my life, you know, the compulsive eating, the rage, any dysfunctional behavior that I've done, it was based on a set of beliefs I had that were very wrong. But the problem was I couldn't just say, oh, that's a wrong belief. I'm not going to believe that anymore. I was really powerless over all of that. And I needed to do the tools, but even more importantly, I needed to do the steps to clear out the wreckage or the blocks. And my sponsor had said to me that I have a channel to my higher power, and that channel is all blocked up by lies, fears, resentments, addictions. And in order to become unblocked, I work this program and I work with a sponsor so that we can remove some of these blocks that are keeping the sunlight of the spirit away from me. and I want the sunlight of the spirit to be within me. That's why I have to take the action to work the steps. You know, step one looked different for me than it might for other people. My, part of my step one was checking into treatment a couple of times. What else was part of my step one? I mean, living in halfway houses. Does everybody have to do that? No, but I did. That was part of me learning that I'm powerless over food. My life is unmanageable and I need a lot of help. And you know, whatever anybody needs to do to get there is what they need to do to get there. You know, eventually, you know, step two, you know, believing a power greater than me can restore me to sanity. For me, sometimes also, I like being able to think of the steps in a way that everybody can relate to them, whether they're religious or spiritual or not. So like I said, that first step was doing those actions that I didn't necessarily want to do, but I did them because it basically was me saying I'm powerless. But then that second step, coming to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity, for me, that might mean going to meetings and listening with an open mind. It might mean getting a sponsor and being honest with them. I'm the last one to say getting a sponsor and doing whatever they want me to do, because that was never my experience. I was always too angry and rebellious for that. But at least get a sponsor and being honest with what's going on with me. That's step two. You know, step three, my sponsor told me, step three is making a decision to work the rest of the 12 steps. This was my sponsor's opinion again, which I kind of believe. She said, it's very hard at step three to be in self-will and just say, here, God, take my self-will. I don't want it anymore. No, she said, what we can do is say, I'm going to make a decision to work thoroughly through the rest of the steps. That's turning my will over. And then in four, you know, I look honestly at my anger. And I am so grateful. I never could have done this without OA. I don't poo-poo my anger or minimize it. I shouldn't feel angry because of that. Oh, that's just so petty. And I know people, I have friends of mine that talk like that, but that never works for me. That never worked for me. I took all, in my step four, I took all the anger I had. I took it very, very seriously. I wrote about it in step four. I turned it around. I looked at, with the help of a sponsor, what was at the root of it. But nothing was too petty. Nothing was too petty. If I was angry about it, it went down on paper. And I'm still that way today. Would I feel comfortable shouting that to the people that I work with and, you know, tell me, hey, you know, I'm angry about the stupidest things and everything gets my goat and I'm just never, no, but in program, there's a safe place for me to be real with my anger. I mean, some of the silly things I got, I mean, I've flown into rages when people haven't behaved the way I wanted them to behave. And I can give very specific examples, but I'm not sure it would be helpful, but it's almost kind of embarrassing. Well, those people and those situations went on my fourth step. And those rages were because I was really, really angry. Was it something that most people would think, wow, that's ridiculous and that's petty? Yes. But hey, I want to recover here. In step five, having that trusted person that can hear without judgment, you know, what I've written down in four. Six and seven, honestly, looking at my defects, I have found certain pieces of literature that really work for me. In other words, they fit me like a glove. And what I tell, I'm not the type, I don't believe that I can sit here and tell you, this is the literature you have to embrace because it will fit you like a glove and get you well. No, I think that we are, that's one of the things I really like about OA. We are a diverse group. Even our literature reflects our diversity. The literature that works for me is pretty old fashioned, AA, you know, the standard selfishness, self-centeredness that we think is the root of our problems. That fits me like a glove. Might not fit you like a glove, but find something that fits like a glove and work it. You know, I found the literature that fits me like a glove. The defects are great. I mean, I never would have known my, I always knew that my motives were screwed up, but in OA, I got to really analyze it and figure out why. Like, why am I crying? Oh, because I want attention. It's not real tears. Why am I acting like I care about this person? Oh, because I want to appear a certain way. Like, it's got me to see what's really underneath my behavior. It's been good to look at that because I always knew that something felt off about my behavior. And people would say, no, no, you're fine. Everybody does that. But inside, I was like, no, this doesn't feel right. This feels off. So let's see, getting to the latter steps. Well, actually eight and nine, making amends. I don't have a whole lot of time to go through all of them. I have made most of my amends. I still continue to need to make daily amends. And then living in the latter steps, you know, 11 and 12, having that quiet time is so important. And the 12 step, the OA responsibility pledge is really good. You know, always to extend the hand and heart of OA to all who share my compulsion. For this, I am responsible. Hopefully by the time I get to step 12, I want to be giving it away and helping others. That's the point of clearing up all the wreckage. If I'm still eating or if I'm still, you know, in knots around resentments, the thought is, how available? If I'm a vessel that's full of, you know, anger, fear, resentment, selfishness, doubt, insecurity, how effective am I going to be to carry the message? No, I have to Roto-Root, get, you know, go through the steps so I can be a vessel, a channel, and have something to give away. And I guess I was taking notes during the, and I'll end with this because I like to say something relevant. Actually, no, I think I'm going to end with Roseanne's prayer, which I wrote down before we got on the meeting. By the way, this is a book I read this year. The only reason I have the audacity to display it is because it is conference approved literature. It's called Beyond Our Wildest Dreams, A History of Overeaters Anonymous as Seen by a Co-Founder. And that gave me a lot of gratitude for the people that came before me because they worked their butts off. They worked their butts off to get this fellowship up and running. I'm glad it wasn't me because it was too much work. They were up in the middle of the night answering snail mail. You know, it was just bad. Raising kids, taking care of husbands. They did a lot. But anyway, it was really important for me to read this. It kind of got me out of that complacency mode and made me think, if I think I have to do a lot, you know, let me look at what they sacrificed. I'll end with this prayer. And that's Roseanne's prayer, our founder. I put my hand in yours, and together we can do what we could never do alone. No longer is there a sense of hopelessness. No longer must we each depend upon our own unsteady willpower. We are all together now, reaching out our hands for power and strength greater than ours. And as we join hands, we find love and understanding beyond our wildest dreams. So I guess I'll end there. Seems like a good prayer to end with.